plant alive. Grown to manhood, Dionysus wandered far to strange places. The lands of Lydia, rich in gold, of Phrygia too, the sun-struck plains of Persia, the great walls of Bactria, the storm-swept country of the Medes, and Araby the Blessed. Everywhere he taught men the culture of the vine and the mysteries of his worship, and everywhere they accepted him as a god, until he drew near to his own country. One day, over the sea near Greece, a pirate's ship came sailing. On a great headland by the shore, they saw a beautiful youth. His rich dark hair flowed down over a purple cloak that covered his strong shoulders. He looked like a son of kings, one whose parents could pay a great ransom. Exulting, the sailors sprang ashore and seized him. On board the ship, they fetched rude bonds to fetter him with. But to their amazement, they were unable to bind him. The ropes would not hold together. They fell apart when they touched his hands or feet. And he sat looking at them with a smile in his dark eyes. Alone among them, the helmsman understood and cried out that this must be a god and should be set free at once, or deadly harm would come to them. But the captain mocked him for a silly fool and bade the crew hasten to hoist the sail. The wind filled it, and the men drew taut the sheets, but the ship did not move. Then, wonder upon wonder happened. Fragrant wine ran in streams down the deck. A vine with many clusters spread out over the sail. A dark green ivy plant twined around the mast like a garland, with flowers in it and lovely fruits. Terror-stricken, the pirates ordered the helmsman to put in to land. Too late, for as they spoke, their captive became a lion, roaring and glaring terribly. At that, they leaped overboard and instantly were changed into dolphins, all except the good helmsman. On him, the god had mercy. He held him back and bade him take courage, for he had found favor with one who was indeed a god, Dionysus, whom Semele bore in union with Zeus. When he passed through Thrace, on his way to Greece, the god was insulted by one of the kings there, Lycurgus, who bitterly opposed this new worship. Dionysus retreated before him and even took refuge from him in the depths of the sea. But later he came back, overpowered him, and punished him for his wickedness, though mildly, by imprisoning him within a rocky cave until his first fierce, maddening rage passed slowly, and he learned to know the god whom he had mocked. But the other gods were not mild. Zeus struck Lycurgus blind, and he died soon after. None lived long who strove with gods. Sometime during his wanderings, Dionysus came upon the princess of Crete, Ariadne, when she was utterly desolate, having been abandoned on the shore of the island of Naxos by the Athenian prince Theseus, whose life she had saved. Dionysus had compassion upon her. He rescued her, and in the end, loved her. When she died, Dionysus took a crown he had given her and placed it among the stars. The mother whom he had never seen was not forgotten. He longed for her so greatly that at last he dared the terrible descent to the lower world to seek her. When he found her, he defied the power of death to keep her from him, and death yielded. Dionysus brought her away, but not to live on earth. He took her up to Olympus, where the gods consented to receive her as one of themselves, a mortal indeed, but the mother of a god, and therefore fit to dwell with immortals. The god of wine could be kind and beneficent. He could also be cruel and drive men on to frightful deeds. Often he made them mad. The Maenads, or the Bacchantes, as they were also called, were women frenzied with wine. They rushed through the woods and over mountains, uttering sharp cries. Waving pinecone-tipped wands, swept away in a fierce ecstasy. Nothing could stop them. They would tear to pieces the wild creatures they met and devour the bloody shreds of flesh. They sang, "Oh, sweet upon the mountain, the dancing and the singing, the maddening rushing flight. Oh, sweet to sink to earth outworn when the wild goat has been hunted and caught. Oh, the joy of the blood and the raw red flesh." The gods of Olympus loved order and beauty in their sacrifices and their temples. The mad women, the Maenads, had no temples. They went to the wilderness to worship, to the wildest mountains, the deepest forests, as if they kept to the customs of an ancient time before men had thought of building houses for their gods. They went out of the dusty, crowded city, back to the lean purity of the untrodden hills and woodlands. There Dionysus gave them food and drink, herbs and berries and the milk of the wild goat. Their beds were on the soft meadow grass, under the thick-leaved trees, where the pine needles fall year after year. They woke to a sense of peace and heavenly freshness. They bathed in a clear brook. There was much that was lovely, good, and freeing in this worship under the open sky and the ecstasy of joy it brought in the wild beauty of the world. And yet, always present, too, was the horrible bloody feast. The worship of Dionysus was centered in these two ideas, so far apart, of freedom and ecstatic joy, and of savage brutality. The god of wine could give either to his worshippers. Throughout the story of his life, he is sometimes man's blessing, sometimes his ruin. Of all the terrible deeds laid to his account, the worst was done in Thebes, his mother's city. Dionysus came to Thebes to establish his worship there. He was accompanied, as was his custom, by a train of women dancing and singing exultant songs, wearing fawn skins over their robes, waving ivy-wreathed wands. They seemed mad with joy. They sang, "O Bacchanals, come, O come, sing, Dionysus, sing to the timbrel, the deep-voiced timbrel, joyfully praise him, him who brings joy. Holy, all holy, music is calling. To the hills, fly, O Bacchanal, swift of foot, on, O joyful, be fleet." Pentheus, the king of Thebes, was the son of Semele's sister. But he had no idea that the leader of this band of excited, strange-acting women was his own cousin. He did not know that when Semele died, Zeus had saved her child. The wild dancing and the loud, joyous singing and the generally queer behavior of these strangers seemed to him highly objectionable, and to be stopped at once. Pentheus ordered his guards to seize and imprison the visitors, especially the leader, whose face is flushed with wine, a cheating sorcerer from Lydia. But as he said these words, he heard behind him a solemn warning. "The man you reject is a new god. He is Semele's child, whom Zeus rescued. He, with divine Demeter, is greatest upon earth for men." The speaker was the old blind prophet Tiresias, the holy man of Thebes, who knew as no one else the will of the gods. But as Pentheus turned to answer him, he saw that he was tricked out like the wild women, a wreath of ivy on his white hair, his old shoulders covered by a fawn skin, a queer pine-tipped stick in his trembling hand. Pentheus laughed mockingly as he looked him over, and then ordered him with contempt out of his sight. Thus he brought upon himself his doom. He would not hear when the gods spoke to him. Dionysus was led in before him by a band of his soldiers. They said he had not tried to flee or to resist, but had done all possible to make it easy for them to seize and bring him, until they felt ashamed, and told him they were acting under orders, not of their own free will. They declared, too, that the maidens they had imprisoned had all escaped to the mountains. The fetters would not keep fastened. The doors unbarred themselves. "This man," they said, "has come to Thebes with many wonders." Pentheus, by now, was blind to everything except his anger and his scorn. He spoke roughly to Dionysus, who answered him with entire gentleness, seeming to try to reach his real self and open his eyes to see that he was face to face with divinity. He warned him that he could not keep him in prison, "for God will set me free."
"God?" Pentheus asked jeeringly.
"Yes," Dionysus answered. "He is here and sees my suffering."
"Not where my eyes can see him," Pentheus said.
"He is where I am," answered Dionysus. "You cannot see him, for you are not pure." Pentheus angrily ordered the soldiers to bind him and take him to the prison, and Dionysus went, saying, "The wrongs you do to me are wrongs done to the gods." But the prison could not hold Dionysus. He came forth, and going to Pentheus again, he tried to persuade him to yield to what these wonders plainly showed was divine, and welcome this new worship of a new and great god. When, however, Pentheus only heaped insults and threats upon him, Dionysus left him to his doom. It was the most horrible that there could be. Pentheus went to pursue the god's followers among the hills where the maidens had fled when they escaped from prison. Many of the Theban women had joined them. Pentheus's mother and her sisters were there. And there, Dionysus showed himself in his most terrible aspect. He made them all mad. The women thought Pentheus a wild beast, a mountain lion, and they rushed to destroy him, his mother first. As they fell upon him, he knew at last that he had fought against a god and must pay with his life. They tore him limb from limb, and then, only then, the god restored their senses, and his mother saw what she had done. Looking at her in her agony, the maidens, all sobered now, the dancing over, and the singing, and the wild wand waving, said to one another, "In strange ways, hard to know, gods come to men. Many a thing past hope they had fulfilled, and what was looked for went another way. A path we never thought to tread, God found for us. So has this come to pass." The ideas about Dionysus in these various stories seem at first sight contradictory. In one, he is the joy god, he whose locks are bound with gold, ruddy Bacchus, comrade of the Maenads, whose blithe torch blazes. In another, he is the heartless god, savage, brutal, he who with a mocking laugh hunts his prey, snares and drags him to his death with his bacchanals. The truth is, however, that both ideas arose quite simply and reasonably from the fact of his being the god of wine. Wine is bad as well as good. It cheers and warms men's hearts. It also makes them drunk. The Greeks were a people who saw facts very clearly. They could not shut their eyes to the ugly and degrading side of wine drinking and see only the delightful side. Dionysus was the god of the vine. Therefore, he was a power which sometimes made men commit frightful and atrocious crimes. No one could defend them. No one would ever try to defend the fate Pentheus suffered. But, the Greeks said to each other, such things really do happen when people are frenzied with drink. This truth did not blind them to the other truth, that wine was the merrymaker, lightening men's hearts, bringing careless ease and fun and gaiety. The wine of Dionysus, when the weary cares of men leave every heart, we travel to a land that never was. The poor grow rich, the rich grow great of heart. All conquering are the shafts made from the vine. The reason that Dionysus was so different at one time from another was because of this double nature of wine, and so of the god of wine. He was man's benefactor, and he was man's destroyer. On his beneficent side, he was not only the god that makes men merry, his cup was life-giving, healing every ill. Under his influence, courage was quickened and fear banished, at any rate for the moment. He uplifted his worshippers. He made them feel that they could do what they had thought they could not. All this happy freedom and confidence passed away, of course, as they either grew sober or got drunk. But while it lasted, it was like being possessed by a power greater than themselves. So people felt about Dionysus as about no other god. He was not only outside of them, he was within them too. They could be transformed by him into being like him. The momentary sense of exultant power wine drinking can give was only a sign to show men that they had within them more than they knew. They could themselves become divine. To think in this way was far removed from the old idea of worshipping the god by drinking enough to be gay, or to be freed from care, or to get drunk. There were followers of Dionysus who never drank wine at all. It is not known when the great change took place, lifting the god who freed men for a moment through drunkenness to the god who freed them through inspiration. But one very remarkable result of it made Dionysus, for all future ages, the most important of the gods of Greece. The Eleusinian mysteries, which were always chiefly Demeter's, had, indeed, great importance. For hundreds of years they helped men, as Cicero said, to live with joy and to die with hope. But their influence did not last, very likely because nobody was allowed to teach their ideas openly or write about them. In the end, only a dim memory of them was left. It was quite otherwise with Dionysus. What was done at his great festival was open to all the world, and is a living influence today. No other festival in Greece could compare with it. It took place in the spring, when the vine begins to put forth its branches, and it lasted for 5 days. They were days of perfect peace and enjoyment. All the ordinary business of life stopped. No one could be put in prison. Prisoners were even released so that they could share in the general rejoicing. But the place where people gathered to do honor to the god was not a wild wilderness made horrible by savage deeds and a bloody feast. It was not even a temple precinct with ordered sacrifices and priestly ceremonies. It was a theater, and the ceremony was the performance of a play. The greatest poetry in Greece, and among the greatest in the world, was written for Dionysus. The poets who wrote the plays, the actors and singers who took part in them, were all regarded as servants of the god. The performances were sacred. The spectators, too, along with the writers and the performers, were engaged in an act of worship. Dionysus himself was supposed to be present. His priest had the seat of honor. It is clear, therefore, that the idea of the god of holy inspiration, who could fill men with his spirit to write gloriously and to act gloriously, became far more important than the earlier ideas of him. The first tragic plays, which are among the best there are, never equaled, except by Shakespeare, were produced in the theater of Dionysus. Comedies were produced there too, but tragedies far outnumbered them, and there was a reason why. This strange god, the gay reveler, the cruel hunter, the lofty inspirer, was also the sufferer. He, like Demeter, was afflicted, not because of grief for another, as she was, but because of his own pain. He was the vine, which is always pruned as nothing else that bears fruits, every branch cut away, only the bare stalk left. Through the winter, a dead thing to look at, an old, gnarled stump, seeming incapable of ever putting forth leaves again. Like Persephone, Dionysus died with the coming of the cold. Unlike her, his death was terrible. He was torn to pieces, in some stories by the Titans, in others by Hera's orders. He was always brought back to life. He died and rose again. It was his joyful resurrection they celebrated in his theater, but the idea of terrible deeds done to him and done by men under his influence was too closely associated with him ever to be forgotten. He was more than the suffering god, he was the tragic god. There was none other. He had still another side. He was the assurance that death does not end all. His worshippers believed that his death and resurrection showed that the soul lives on forever after the body dies. This faith was part of the mysteries of Eleusis. At first, it centered in Persephone, who also rose from the dead every spring. But as queen of the black underworld, she kept, even in the bright world above, a suggestion of something strange and awful. How could she, who carried always about her the reminder of death, stand for the resurrection, the conquest of death? Dionysus, on the contrary, was never thought of as a power in the kingdom of the dead. There are many stories about Persephone in the lower world, only one about Dionysus. He rescued his mother from it. In his resurrection, he was the embodiment of the life that is stronger than death. He, and not Persephone, became the center of the belief in immortality. Around the year 80 AD, a great Greek writer, Plutarch, received news when he was far from home that a little daughter of his had died. A child of most gentle nature, he says. In his letter to his wife, he writes, "About that which you have heard, dear heart, that the soul, once departed from the body, vanishes and feels nothing, I know that you give no belief to such assertions, because of those sacred and faithful promises given in the mysteries of Bacchus, which we who are of that religious brotherhood know. We hold it firmly for an undoubted truth that our soul is incorruptible and immortal. We are to think of the dead that they pass into a better place and a happier condition. Let us behave ourselves accordingly, outwardly ordering our lives, while within all should be purer, wiser, incorruptible." Chapter 3. How the World and Mankind Were Created. With the exception of the story of Prometheus's punishment, told by Aeschylus in the 5th century, I have taken the material of this chapter chiefly from Hesiod, who lived at least 300 years earlier. He is the principal authority for the myths about the beginning of everything. Both the crudity of the story of Cronus and the naivete of the story of Pandora are characteristic of him. First, there was chaos, the vast, immeasurable abyss, outrageous as a sea, dark, wasteful, wild. These words are Milton's, but they express, with precision, what the Greeks thought lay back of the very first beginning of things. Long before the gods appeared, in the dim past, uncounted ages ago, there was only the formless confusion of chaos brooded over by unbroken darkness. At last, but how no one ever tried to explain, two children were born to this shapeless nothingness. Night was the child of chaos, and so was Erebus, which is the unfathomable depth where death dwells. In the whole universe there was nothing else. All was black, empty, silent, endless. And then, A marvel of marvels came to pass. In some mysterious way, from this horror of blank, boundless vacancy, the best of all things came into being. A great playwright, the comic poet Aristophanes, describes its coming in words often quoted. Black-winged night, into the bosom of Erebus, dark and deep, laid a wind-born egg, and as the seasons rolled, forth sprang love, the longed-for, shining with wings of gold. From darkness and from death, love was born, and with its birth, order and beauty began to banish blind confusion. Love created light, with its companion, radiant day. What took place next was the creation of the earth, but this too no one ever tried to explain. It just happened. With the coming of love and light, it seemed natural that the earth also should appear. The poet Hesiod, the first Greek who tried to explain how things began, wrote, "Earth, the beautiful, rose up, broad-bosomed, she that is the steadfast base of all things. And fair earth first bore the starry heaven, equal to herself, to cover her on all sides, and to be a home forever for the blessed gods." In all this thought about the past, no distinction had as yet been made between places and persons. Earth was the solid ground, yet vaguely a personality, too. Heaven was the blue vault on high, but it acted in some ways as a human being would. To the people who told these stories, all the universe was alive with the same kind of life they knew in themselves. They were individual persons, so they personified everything which had the obvious marks of life, everything which moved and changed. Earth in winter and summer, the sky with its shifting stars, the restless sea, and so on. It was only a dim personification, something vague and immense, which, with its motion, brought about change, and therefore was alive. But when they told of the coming of love and light, the early storytellers were setting the scene for the appearance of mankind, and they began to personify more precisely. They gave natural forces distinct shapes. They thought of them as the precursors of men, and they defined them far more clearly as individuals than they had earth and heaven. They showed them acting in every way as human beings did. Walking, for instance, and eating, as earth and heaven obviously did not, these two were set apart. If they were alive, it was in a way peculiar to them alone. The first creatures who had the appearance of life were the children of Mother Earth and Father Heaven, Gaia and Uranus. They were monsters. Just as we believe that the earth was once inhabited by strange, gigantic creatures, so did the Greeks. They did not, however, think of them as huge lizards and mammoths, but as somewhat like men, and yet unhuman. They had the shattering, overwhelming strength of earthquake and hurricane and volcano. In the tales about them, they do not seem really alive, but rather to belong to a world where, as yet, there was no life, only tremendous movements of irresistible forces lifting up the mountains and scooping out the seas. The Greeks apparently had some such feeling, because in their stories, although they represent these creatures as living beings, they make them unlike any form of life known to man. Three of them, monstrously huge and strong, had each 100 hands and 50 heads. To three others was given the name of Cyclops, the wheel-eyed, because each had only one enormous eye, as round and as big as a wheel, in the middle of the forehead. The Cyclopes, too, were gigantic, towering up like mighty mountain crags and devastating in their power. Last came the Titans. There were a number of these, and they were in no way inferior to the others in size and strength, but they were not purely destructive.
Several of them were even beneficent. One, indeed, after men had been created, saved them from destruction. It was natural to think of these fearful creations as the children of Mother Earth, brought forth from her dark depths when the world was young. But it is extremely odd that they were also the children of heaven. However, that was what the Greeks said, and they made heaven out to be a very poor father. He hated the things with 100 hands and 50 heads, even though they were his sons, and as each was born, he imprisoned it in a secret place within the earth. The Cyclopes and the Titans he left at large, and Earth, enraged at the maltreatment of her other children, appealed to them to help her. Only one was bold enough, the Titan Cronus. He lay in wait for his father and wounded him terribly. The giants, the fourth race of monsters, sprang up from his blood. From this same blood, too, the Erinyes, the Furies, were born. Their office was to pursue and punish sinners. They were called those who walk in the darkness, and they were terrible of aspect, with writhing snakes for hair and eyes that wept tears of blood. The other monsters were finally driven from the earth, but not the Erinyes. As long as there was sin in the world, they could not be banished. From that time on, for untold ages, Cronus, he whom, as we have seen, the Romans called Saturn, was lord of the universe, with his sister queen, Rhea, Ops in Latin. Finally, one of their sons, the future ruler of heaven and earth, whose name in Greek is Zeus and in Latin Jupiter, rebelled against him. He had good cause to do so, for Cronus had learned that one of his children was destined someday to dethrone him, and he thought to go against fate by swallowing them as soon as they were born. But when Rhea bore Zeus, her sixth child, she succeeded in having him secretly carried off to Crete, while she gave her husband a great stone wrapped in swaddling clothes, which he supposed was the baby, and swallowed down accordingly. Later, when Zeus was grown, he forced his father, with the help of his grandmother, the Earth, to disgorge it, along with the 5 earlier children, and it was set up at Delphi, where, eons later, a great traveler, Pausanias by name, reports that he saw it about 180 AD. A stone of no great size, which the priests of Delphi anoint every day with oil. There followed a terrible war between Cronus, helped by his brother Titans, against Zeus with his 5 brothers and sisters. A war that almost wrecked the universe. A dreadful sound troubled the boundless sea. The whole earth uttered a great cry. Wide heaven, shaken, groaned. From its foundation, far Olympus reeled beneath the onrush of the deathless gods, and trembling, seized upon black Tartarus. The Titans were conquered, partly because Zeus released from their prison the 100-handed monsters who fought for him with their irresistible weapons, thunder, lightning, and earthquake, and also because one of the sons of the Titan Iapetus, whose name was Prometheus, and who was very wise, took sides with Zeus. Zeus punished his conquered enemies terribly. They were bound in bitter chains beneath the wide-wayed earth, as far below the earth as over earth is heaven. For even so far down lies Tartarus. 9 days and nights would a bronze anvil fall, and on the 10th reach earth from heaven. And then again falling 9 days and nights would come to Tartarus, the brazen-fenced. Prometheus's brother Atlas suffered a still worse fate. He was condemned to bear on his back forever the cruel strength of the crushing world and the vault of the sky, upon his shoulders the great pillar that holds apart the earth and heaven, a load not easy to be borne.
Bearing this burden, he stands forever before the place that is wrapped in clouds and darkness, where night and day draw near and greet one another. The house within never holds both night and day, but always one, departing, visits the earth, and the other, in the house, awaits the hour for her journeying hence. One with far-seeing light for those on earth, the other, holding in her hands, sleep, the brother of death. Even after the Titans were conquered and crushed, Zeus was not completely victorious. Earth gave birth to her last and most frightful offspring, a creature more terrible than any that had gone before. His name was Typhon. A flaming monster with 100 heads, who rose up against all the gods. Death whistled from his fearful jaws, his eyes flashed glaring fire. But Zeus had now got the thunder and lightning under his own control. They had become his weapons, used by no one else. He struck Typhon down with the bolt that never sleeps, thunder with breath of flame. Into his very heart the fire burned. His strength was turned to ashes, and now he lies a useless thing by Etna, whence sometimes there burst rivers red hot, consuming with fierce jaws the level fields of Sicily, lovely with fruits. And that is Typhon's anger boiling up, his fire-breathing darts. Still later, one more attempt was made to unseat Zeus. The giants rebelled. But by this time the gods were very strong, and they were helped too by mighty Hercules, a son of Zeus. The giants were defeated and hurled down to Tartarus, and the victory of the radiant powers of heaven over the brutal forces of earth was complete. From then on, Zeus and his brothers and sisters ruled, undisputed lords of all. As yet, there were no human beings. But the world, now cleared of the monsters, was ready for mankind. It was a place where people could live in some comfort and security, without having to fear the sudden appearance of a titan or a giant. The earth was believed to be a round disk, divided into two equal parts by the sea, as the Greeks called it, which we know as the Mediterranean, and by what we call the Black Sea. The Greeks called this first the Axine, which means the unfriendly sea, and then, perhaps as people became familiar with it, the Euxine, the friendly sea. It is sometimes suggested that they gave it this pleasant name to make it feel pleasantly disposed toward them. Around the earth flowed the great river Ocean, never troubled by wind or storm. On the farther bank of Ocean were mysterious people, whom few on earth ever found their way to. The Cimmerians lived there, but whether east, west, north, or south, no one knew. It was a land cloud-wrapped and misty, where the light of day was never seen, upon which the shining sun never looked with his splendor, not when he climbed through the starry sky at dawn, nor when at evening he turned toward the earth from the sky. Endless night was spread over its melancholy people. Except in this one country, all those who lived across ocean were exceedingly fortunate. In the remotest north, so far away it was at the back of the north wind, was a blissful land where the Hyperboreans lived. Only a few strangers, great heroes, had ever visited it. Not by ship, nor yet on foot, might one find the road to the marvelous meeting place of the Hyperboreans. But the Muses lived not far from them. Such were their ways, for everywhere the dance of maidens swayed, and the clear call of the lyre sounded, and the ringing notes of flutes. With golden laurel they bound their hair, and they feasted merrily. In that holy race, sickness and deathly old age had no part. Far to the south was the country of the Ethiopians, of whom we know only that the gods held them in such favor they would sit at joyful banquets with them in their halls. On Ocean's bank, too, was the abode of the blessed dead. In that land, there was no snowfall, nor much winter, nor any storm of rain, but from ocean the west wind sang soft and thrillingly to refresh the souls of men. Here, those who kept themselves pure from all wrong came when they left the earth. Their boon is life forever freed from toil, no more to trouble earth or the sea waters with their strong hands, laboring for the food that does not satisfy, but with the honored of the gods they live a life where there are no more tears. Around those blessed isles soft sea winds breathe, and flowers of gold are blazing on the trees, upon the waters too. By now, all was ready for the appearance of mankind. Even the places the good and bad should go to after death had been arranged. It was time for men to be created. There is more than one account of how that came to pass. Some say it was delegated by the gods to Prometheus, the Titan who had sided with Zeus in the war with the Titans, and to his brother, Epimetheus. Prometheus, whose name means forethought, was very wise, wiser even than the gods. But Epimetheus, which means afterthought, was a scatterbrained person who invariably followed his first impulse and then changed his mind. So he did in this case. Before making men, he gave all the best gifts to the animals, strength and swiftness and courage and shrewd cunning, fur and feathers and wings and shells and the like, until no good was left for men, no protective covering, and no quality to make them a match for the beasts. Too late, as always, he was sorry and asked his brother's help. Prometheus then took over the task of creation and thought out a way to make mankind superior. He fashioned them in a nobler shape than the animals, upright, like the gods. And then he went to heaven, to the sun, where he lit a torch and brought down fire, a protection to men far better than anything else, whether fur or feathers or strength or swiftness. And now, though feeble and short-lived, mankind has flaming fire, and therefrom learns many crafts. According to another story, the gods themselves created men. They made first a golden race. These, although mortal, lived like gods, without sorrow of heart, far from toil and pain. The cornland of itself bore fruit abundantly. They were rich also in flocks and beloved of the gods. When the grave covered them, they became pure spirits, beneficent, the guardians of mankind. In this account of the creation, the gods seemed bent on experimenting with the various metals, and, oddly enough, proceeding downward from the excellent to the good to the worse, and so on. When they had tried gold, they went to silver. This second race of silver was very inferior to the first. They had so little intelligence that they could not keep from injuring each other. They too passed away. But unlike the gold race, their spirits did not live on after them. The next race was of brass. They were terrible men, immensely strong, and such lovers of war and violence that they were completely destroyed by their own hands. This, however, was all to the good, for they were followed by a splendid race of godlike heroes who fought glorious wars and went on great adventures which men have talked and sung of through all the ages since. They departed finally to the Isles of the Blessed, where they lived in perfect bliss forever. The fifth race is that which is now upon the earth, the Iron Race. They live in evil times, and their nature too has much of evil, so that they never have rest from toil and sorrow. As the generations pass, they grow worse. Sons are always inferior to their fathers. A time will come when they have grown so wicked that they will worship power, might will be right to them, and reverence for the good will cease to be. At last, when no man is angry any more at wrongdoing, or feels shame in the presence of the miserable, Zeus will destroy them too. And yet, even then something might be done if only the common people would arise and put down rulers that oppress them. These two stories of the creation, the story of the five ages and the story of Prometheus and Epimetheus, different as they are, agree in one point. For a long time, certainly throughout the happy golden age, only men were upon the earth. There were no women. Zeus created these later, in his anger at Prometheus for caring so much for men. Prometheus had not only stolen fire for men, he had also arranged that they should get the best part of any animal sacrificed, and the gods the worst. He cut up a great ox and wrapped the good eatable parts in the hide, disguising them further by piling entrails on top. Beside this heap, he put another of all the bones, dressed up with cunning and covered with shining fat, and bade Zeus choose between them. Zeus took up the white fat, and was angry when he saw the bones craftily tricked out. But he had made his choice, and he had to abide by it. Thereafter, only fat and bones were burned to the gods upon their altars. Men kept the good meat for themselves. But the father of men and of gods was not one to put up with this sort of treatment. He swore to be revenged, on mankind first, and then on mankind's friend. He made a great evil for men, a sweet and lovely thing to look upon, in the likeness of a shy maiden, and all the gods gave her gifts, silvery raiment, and a broidered veil, a wonder to behold, and bright garlands of blooming flowers, and a crown of gold. Great beauty shone out from it. Because of what they gave her, they called her Pandora, which means the gift of all. When this beautiful disaster had been made, Zeus brought her out, and wonder took hold of gods and men when they beheld her. From her, the first woman, comes the race of women, who are an evil to men, with a nature to do evil. Another story about Pandora is that the source of all misfortune was not her wicked nature, but only her curiosity. The gods presented her with a box into which each had put something harmful, and forbade her ever to open it. Then they sent her to Epimetheus, who took her gladly, although Prometheus had warned him never to accept anything from Zeus. He took her, and afterward, when that dangerous thing, a woman, was his, he understood how good his brother's advice had been. For Pandora, like all women, was possessed of a lively curiosity. She had to know what was in the box. One day, she lifted the lid, and out flew plagues innumerable, sorrow and mischief for mankind. In terror, Pandora clapped the lid down, but too late. One good thing, however, was there. Hope. It was the only good the casket had held among the many evils, and it remains to this day mankind's sole comfort in misfortune. So mortals learn that it is not possible to get the better of Zeus or ever deceive him. The wise and compassionate Prometheus, too, found that out. When Zeus had punished men by giving them women, he turned his attention to the arch-sinner himself. The new ruler of the gods owed Prometheus much for helping him conquer the other Titans, but he forgot his debt. Zeus had his servants, Force and Violence, seize him and take him to the Caucasus, where they bound him to a high-piercing, headlong rock in adamantine chains that none can break. And they told him, "Forever shall the intolerable present grind you down." and he who will release you is not born. Such fruit you reap for your man-loving ways. A god yourself, you did not dread God's anger, but gave to mortals honor not their due. And therefore, you must guard this joyless rock. No rest, no sleep, no moment's respite. Groans shall your speech be, lamentation your only words.
The reason for inflicting this torture was not only to punish Prometheus, but also to force him to disclose a secret very important to the Lord of Olympus. Zeus knew that fate, which brings all things to pass, had decreed that a son should someday be born to him who would dethrone him and drive the gods from their home in heaven. But only Prometheus knew who would be the mother of this son. As he lay bound upon the rock in agony, Zeus sent his messenger, Hermes, to bid him disclose the secret. Prometheus told him,
"Go and persuade the sea wave not to break. You will persuade me no more easily."
Hermes warned him that if he persisted in his stubborn silence, he should suffer still more terrible things. "An eagle red with blood shall come, a guest unbidden to your banquet. All day long he will tear to rags your body, feasting in fury on the blackened liver." But nothing, no threat nor torture, could break Prometheus. His body was bound, but his spirit was free. He refused to submit to cruelty and tyranny. He knew that he had served Zeus well, and that he had done right to pity mortals in their helplessness. His suffering was utterly unjust, and he would not give in to brutal power, no matter at what cost. He told Hermes,
"There is no force which can compel my speech. So let Zeus hurl his blazing bolts, and with the white wings of the snow, with thunder and with earthquake, confound the reeling world. None of all this will bend my will."
Hermes, crying out, "Why, these are ravings you may hear from madmen," left him to suffer what he must. Generations later, we know he was released, but why and how is not told clearly anywhere. There is a strange story that the centaur, Chiron, though immortal, was willing to die for him, and that he was allowed to do so. When Hermes was urging Prometheus to give in to Zeus, he spoke of this, but in such a way as to make it seem an incredible sacrifice. "Look for no ending to this agony until a god will freely suffer for you, will take on him your pain, and in your stead descend to where the sun is turned to darkness, the black depths of death." But Chiron did do this, and Zeus seems to have accepted him as a substitute. We are told, too, that Hercules slew the eagle and delivered Prometheus from his bonds, and that Zeus was willing to have this done. But why Zeus changed his mind, and whether Prometheus revealed the secret when he was freed, we do not know. One thing, however, is certain. In whatever way the two were reconciled, it was not Prometheus who yielded. His name has stood through all the centuries, from Greek days to our own, as that of the great rebel against injustice and the authority of power. There is still another account of the creation of mankind. In the story of the Five Ages, men are descended from the iron race. In the story of Prometheus, it is uncertain whether the men he saved from destruction belonged to that race or the bronze race. Fire would have been as necessary to the one as to the other. In the third story, men are descended from a race of stone. This story begins with the deluge. All over the earth, men grew so wicked that finally Zeus determined to destroy them. He decided to mingle storm and tempest over boundless earth and make an utter end of mortal man. He sent the flood.
he called upon his brother, the god of the sea, to help him. And together, with torrents of rain from heaven and rivers loosed upon the earth, the two drowned the land. The might of water overwhelmed dark earth. Over the summits of the highest mountains, only towering Parnassus was not quite covered, and the bit of dry land on its very topmost peak was the means by which mankind escaped destruction. After it had rained through 9 days and 9 nights, there came drifting to that spot what looked to be a great wooden chest. But safe within it were two living human beings, a man and a woman. They were Deucalion and Pyrrha, he, Prometheus's son, and she, his niece, the daughter of Epimetheus and Pandora. The wisest person in all the universe, Prometheus, had well been able to protect his own family. He knew the flood would come, and he had bidden his son build the chest, store it with provisions, and embark in it with his wife. Fortunately, Zeus was not offended, because the two were pious, faithful worshippers of the gods. When the chest came to land and they got out, to see no sign of life anywhere, only a wild waste of waters, Zeus pitied them and drained off the flood. Slowly, like the ebbing tide, the sea and the rivers drew back, and the earth was dry again. Pyrrha and Deucalion came down from Parnassus, the only living creatures in a dead world. They found a temple all slimy and moss-grown, but not quite in ruins, and there they gave thanks for their escape and prayed for help in their dreadful loneliness. They heard a voice. "Veil your heads and cast behind you the bones of your mother." The commands struck them with horror. Pyrrha said, "We dare not do such a thing." Deucalion was forced to agree that she was right, but he tried to think out what might lie behind the words, and suddenly he saw their meaning. "Earth is the mother of all," he told his wife. "Her bones are the stones. These we may cast behind us without doing wrong." So they did. And as the stones fell, they took human shape. They were called the Stone People, and they were a hard, enduring race, as was to be expected, and indeed as they had need to be, to rescue the earth from the desolation left by the flood. Chapter 4. The Earliest Heroes. Prometheus and Io. The materials for this story are taken from two poets, the Greek Aeschylus and the Roman Ovid, separated from each other by 450 years, and still more by their gifts and temperaments. They are the best sources for the tale. It is easy to distinguish the parts told by each, Aeschylus grave and direct, Ovid light and amusing. The touch about lovers' lies is characteristic of Ovid, as also the little story about Syrinx. "In those days when Prometheus had just given fire to men, and when he was first bound to the rocky peak on Caucasus, he had a strange visitor. A distracted, fleeing creature came clambering awkwardly up over the cliffs and crags to where he lay. It looked like a heifer, but talked like a girl who seemed mad with misery. The sight of Prometheus stopped her short. She cried, 'This that I see, a form storm-beaten, bound to the rock. Did you do wrong? Is this your punishment? Where am I? Speak to a wretched wanderer. Enough, I have been tried enough, my wandering, long wandering. Yet I have found nowhere to leave my misery. I am a girl who speak to you, but horns are on my head.'" Prometheus recognized her. He knew her story, and he spoke her name. "I know you, girl, Inachus's daughter, Io. You made the god's heart hot with love, and Hera hates you. She it is who drives you on this flight that never ends.
Wonder checked Io's frenzy. She stood still, all amazed. Her name, spoken by this strange being in this strange